Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
There's a trend in Hollywood to talk about the curse of video game movies. When you try to adapt video games into movies, they often turn into, well, pretty bad movies. One of the first would be the Super Mario Brothers movie with, Bob Hoskins, I think, and John Leguizamo. Really, really bad. Though when I was a kid, I loved it, because when you're a kid, you don't recognize that things are bad. But today on the podcast, I want to talk about the stories behind video games, the real life stories that have been turned into films that make them really interesting. Though, as you'll see with our second example, video game, the definition is going to be stretched just a little bit. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist Trent Horn. And today, it's Friday, Free for All Friday. We are free. We're free people. We can talk about whatever I want to talk about. Monday and Wednesday, we talk apologetics and theology. But Friday is a nice day to just unwind and talk about anything that's fun and under the sun. So that's what I want to talk about today. I'm going to share with you three movies, two of them recent, one a classic from all the way back in 2007. Maybe you've heard of it, you probably haven't, but they detail stories behind famous video games, things that took place in real life that make for really interesting drama to show on the big screen. So these aren't movies about video games themselves, but the stories behind the games that are really fascinating. So the first one I want to talk about is Tetris. Oh man, I played Tetris so much as a kid, you have no idea. I had the Game Boy. And if you never played Tetris, so Tetris is short for the tetromino, the little four-piece puzzle piece, and tennis, you put them together. So Tetra, four, and tennis, which was the favorite game of the Soviet engineer who invented Tetris. And the goal with Tetris, it's a puzzle game, and it's so simple and addicting. You get these little four-bit pieces falling down. You got to assemble them into lines, and you got to be able to assemble them all into lines. Otherwise, they'll fill up the screen, and if they fill up the screen, you lose. If you complete a line, the line disappears. Simple, right? And if you ever played Tetris, you probably have that theme stuck in your head. Let's play it again right now. I remember once I was moving our family to California. I had the U-Haul, I had all of the stuff in it, and so we were moving out there. I went by myself, and I was unloading it at a U-Haul storage facility. And I was supposed to unload it that morning and catch a flight back home to my family. I moved everything out and drove the U-Haul by myself. And so I get there, and the U-Haul storage facility, they're supposed to give me one big storage room, right? One big giant room to put all my stuff in. But when I get there, they say, oh yeah, we have your storage facilities. And they gave me like four tiny closets to put my stuff in. And I had unloaders with me that I had paid, I paid them to show up for 2 hours to unload stuff from the truck. And they were actually terrible. They did such a horrible job. 2 hours is up. We weren't finished yet. And they said, oh, you can pay us to do more. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. Get out of here, you bums. I didn't say you bums. That's how I felt. And so I stood there. And there you had the furniture and some of these big pieces and these little closets. And I almost, I don't know, I just got really sad and depressed because I didn't want to miss my flight. What am I going to do with all my stuff? What am I going to do? And I started humming to myself. Do, 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 do. Because this was basically a game of Tetris that I had to play. How do I fit all of this stuff into a little storage container? And I did it. I got it all done, returned the U-Haul, and barely made it back for my flight. So that was the day that Tetris really saved me a life. See, video games can be helpful. Video games do help you in real life. That's why now when we pack up the van for big family road trips, I'll tell my wife, don't worry, I've got this. And she'll hear me in the back of the van packing stuff away. Do, 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 do. Because that's how it is. I think dads are really good at packing things because when they were young, they just played Tetris a bunch. And then it all works. It all fits in there. So there is a recent film that's come out on Apple Plus. It debuted at the end of March. I guess the only place you can watch it is on Apple Plus to subscribe to it. And it's called, appropriately enough, Tetris, written by Noah Pink and directed by John Baird, B-A-I-R-D. And so how do you make a movie about Tetris, right? Just about puzzle pieces dropping. As I said earlier at the beginning of the show, this is not about the game itself. It's a story behind the game. If anything, it's kind of a Cold War spy drama, if you will. I mean, spy drama, I'll put that in quotation marks. But it deals with the real life drama of who had the rights to Tetris, because Tetris was invented by a game designer, well, an engineer, really, in the Soviet Union, came up with this idea for the game, and then it floated around to a lot of different companies, because technically, if he invented it in the Soviet Union, the Soviets would have had rights to it, and it was about how do we get this game and the rights to it out of the Soviet Union to be able to import to the Game Boy, and the struggles that were involved in that. So there's a review here. In this review of the game, this is on the website Bruminate, but also talks about another review in Variety magazine. It talks about how the Tetris game was a hit in the Soviet Union, but getting the rights to distribute it internationally turned into a saga. A large section of the film is dedicated to untangling the mystery of who owns the rights to the game. Many scenes are set in gloomy Soviet-era meeting rooms as the different parties negotiate for the chance to bring the game about falling blocks to the world. The KGB and secret tape recordings add to the feeling of this as a dense historical drama. Tetris is an unexpected treat for fans of spy movies and those who love to know the backstory of their favorite games. And here's a clip from the trailer for Tetris.
The most powerful man in Communist Party is watching you and your family.
Do you know where your husband is?
What the hell is going on?
The world is changing, and Soviet Union will not be left behind.
You want to play with the big boys?
This is how the world works.
Where is my money?
This is insane. We can't protect you.
Sometimes you gotta forget the rules.
Here's a caveat, though, if you want to go see the movie. It's not the most exciting film release of the year, but it does an excellent job of giving us a taste of what it was like to negotiate for a video game during the Cold War. So I've only seen one of these movies, by the way. It was the last one I want to talk about. I have not seen the other two. I may or may not see Tetris. It does sound really interesting, but I hear it's a little bit of a slow burn. It's not as exciting as a movie, but if you really enjoy Tetris, you'll definitely want to, you'll want to check it out. The next one is Pinball. All right. Is Pinball a video game? Well, especially in the 1950s and 60s, pinball has been around for a really long time, actually. Now, when we think of pinball, like when I take my kids as an arcade around here, Electric Starship Arcade, you can pay a membership, like a monthly membership. You can do a day pass or monthly pass, and all the games are free. So it doesn't eat your quarters. You go in, you pay $20, and you can, that's for a month. You can just come back and play any of the old 80s games you want to. And it's great. And they got a whole row of pinball. And it's the newer pinball, the stuff from like the 90s, early 2000s. Probably my favorite one of these games was the Jurassic Park pinball game, because if you got the pinball into the right spot, the T-Rex would eat the pinball. I remember playing that as a kid. Once I went to the movie theaters with my aunt, and I was playing pinball afterwards, and I kept getting free game after free game, and she came over, and she's like, I was so worried. I didn't know what happened to you. You didn't come back. And I said, oh, I just kept getting free game after free game. I was just rocking it on the Jurassic Park pinball game. So I would definitely call pinball a video game, especially in that respect. The newer ones have these video game elements to them. But you get what I'm saying here. But pinball actually goes back a long way. It goes back to a French game called Bagatelle. But though the first pinball game was patented in 1871, when it added the plunger, where you pull back the little stick and it fires the ball into the thing. The thing, what kind of a description is that? So the original game, it was a lot more, I guess, like Plinko, kind of, where you would fire the ball in, you just watch it kind of bounce down these pins and you wonder where it would land. So it was definitely not as much a game of skill, it was more of a game of chance to see what would happen. I guess people were more easily impressed back then. It wasn't until 1947 that pinball games had the flippers, and that really changed how pinball was as a game. You weren't just wondering what would happen to the ball when it would go through. With the flippers, you have a set of skill involved. I love the pinball games, actually, that have dual flippers, where you have flippers in the back and the front that all operate at the same time. It really changes the game up. So here's what's interesting about pinball, and there is a new film directed by, I think it's Austin and Meredith Bragg. It's called Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game. And it is a film about, I think it's about Roger Sharp is his name. This was somebody who helped to make pinball legal in New York because it had been illegal there since like the 1940s. And on a side note, I really enjoy Awesome Meredith Bragg. They do a lot of work at Reason Foundation. They're a libertarian organization. I'm not a full-blown libertarian or anything like that. I certainly do lean that way. But I find a lot of the work they do to be very insightful and super funny. So I love some of the videos they put together. I might do a Free-for-All Friday. They have a wonderful video series called Great the History of Unintended Consequences when government passes laws. And you think for a good end, but it has an unintended consequence and a bad effect. I'll save that for a future Free-for-All Friday. So what happened with pinball, right, is that in the 1930s, pinball machines started showing up in bars and taverns around the country. It was something like a fun game to play in the bleakness of the Great Depression. But during this time period, especially in the 30s and 40s, pinball was seen as a gambling machine, and it was kind of associated with the mob. And so it got this, you know, it's kind of a seedy reputation related to pinball, as, you know, you would gamble over what would happen in a pinball game. And that's how you try to make money on it. You'd play the pinball game. Where does the ball end up? And you gamble on that. So it was associated with organized crime. Then in 1942, the mayor of New York City, Fiorella LaGuardia, right? You've been to LaGuardia Airport. If LaGuardia is a wreck, then it was appropriately named after its mayor, who is kind of a wreck. It says in this article, by 1942, LaGuardia had been trying to ban pinball and a lot of illegal activities in New York. He was trying to clean up New York, so he would use anything he could to get his hands on it. He got most of his ammunition when Pearl Harbor was bombed. They needed materials for the war effort, and pinball has wood, wire, metal, glass, and the resources required for war. Once he had that ammunition, he was able to enact a law to make pinball illegal. So the 1940s, LaGuardia makes pinball illegal. Some people have also speculated he hated the pinball machines because they made him feel short when he would stand in front of them, because he was actually somewhat of a diminutive individual. And so pinball was banned in New York. There was also a popular sentiment to try to ban it. There was a public relations campaign saying that pinball was stealing lunch money from our kids. Like, these were just coin vacuums that were oppressing kids and stealing their lunch money, basically. And we need to ban these things for the public good. So in 1976, a pinball enthusiast, right, I'm pretty sure I have it here, right? Roger Sharp. If I get it wrong, I apologize. He came across a pinball machine, I think, at a peep show, so at an adult venue. So at places that were, you know, seedy, illegal, you weren't allowed to have these games. And he played it, and he loved pinball. And he found out that it was illegal. So he went before the New York City Council and argued his case to save pinball. And he does it in this dramatic event where he proves in a live performance that pinball is a game of skill, not a game of chance that you would regulate under gambling or anything like that. Though the movie Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game, is not just about that. It's also about Bragg. The Bragg brothers say that they really liked the life of Sharp and the story of his love interest, and they thought all of it made for a really good film. And it's gotten pretty high praise, actually. This is one that I might actually see, although I have not seen it, so I can't vouch for any morally offensive elements in it, but I am interested in checking it out for sure. And here's a clip from the pinball movie, the trailer, I mean.
This probably sounds weird, but I play pinball all the time. Helps me focus.
Are you any good?
It may be the thing that I am best at.
Why are they taking the machines?
We got busted.
It never even occurred to me that the game was illegal.
But for over three decades, pinball was banned in New York City.
I want to show the city council members that they've had it wrong for all these years.
Well, you're a reporter.
I just have a question about the pinball ban, sir.
Somebody keep these damn kids away from me.
Finally, the last one is Donkey Kong, the original Donkey Kong on Atari. That is a hard, hard game. When I go to Electric Starship Arcade here in Fort Worth, I try to play that game. I can only last like 90 seconds. The old games were monstrously hard. New video games are like for babies. You play a new video game, like the first 10 minutes of it, it's almost impossible to die. It's just full of tutorials to tell you how to play. And it's designed, to not discourage you. These 80s arcade games, man, they are just like Suck it up, Buttercup. You lost. Put in another quarter. You're out of quarters. Go deliver newspapers. But I just wanted to play paperboy. Tough. If you want to play paperboy, deliver real papers. Then get your quarters and come play. So you had these old games, and they were hard. I remember playing. I still try to play them. I love them at Electric Starship. I love the fact that the games are unlimited free play there. Otherwise, it probably cost me like $40 to play Donkey Kong or Dragon's Lair. Oh, Dragon's Lair is an impossible game. And that's just moving the joystick left or right to make a decision on how to play. So there is a movie, a documentary that came out in 2007. And it was shot on the Canon XL1. I used to shoot on this camera, by the way. It was this big, clunky camera, but it was high tech at the time. It shot on mini DV tapes. And I remember using that model camera when I was in high school to shoot productions, to shoot our youth ministry videos when I was a volunteer in the youth ministry program. So this is shot in the Canon XL1. You can actually, I'm pretty sure you can watch it for free online. It's on YouTube. It's called The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. And here is the description of the game and how it relates to the real life game of Donkey Kong. Though this is not about the history of the game of Donkey Kong per se, but about the battle to be the best at Donkey Kong. And it's really great because it has a wonderful protagonist and antagonist. It says here, The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters is an offbeat yet enjoyable documentary about the unexpectedly cutthroat and bizarre fascination with the world of competitive arcade gaming. Since the early 1980s, Billy Mitchell has been the king of classic arcade games. His Donkey Kong record has stood for 25 years. Then Steve Wiebe, a lifelong challenger and failed baseball player and failed musician, gets a Donkey Kong machine and dedicates himself to becoming number one at the classic game. He tries to challenge Billy's record, but Billy and the Twin Galaxies International Scorekeepers Association put up obstacles in his way.
You want to put a score up, you're competing against everybody in the world.
It's not even about Donkey Kong anymore.
He's a very devious person. He works things out to his ends very well.
Well, Billy Mitchell always has a plan.
And it's just great because Billy Mitchell, he's accused, both of them are accused of cheating. It seems like Billy did cheat. I think he actually was proven to cheat later on. That people would try to get the high scores on these games. And Twin Galaxies was this fan association that tracked the high score, who has the highest score on these games. So, but Twin Galaxies, there's a lot of politics in the film about how they appeal to Billy because he's so famous among the community and they have to play favorites among others. And so Steve Wiebe is like, he's like the Rocky going, but it's not like Apollo Creed because Billy Mitchell is not a nice person. Physically, he looks like a fully grown Peter Dinklage, if I had to describe him. And he's smarmy and he's snake-like and he makes for a really great villain in this documentary that at one point you think Wiebe has got it, he's going to win, and Mitchell comes in with an alleged videotape of him getting another high score on Donkey Kong, and then there's questions about, is it real? Was he using an emulator, a fake version of Donkey Kong, to get the score? You know, I remember back in the day when I played Super Nintendo, they had, Super Nintendo Magazine, you could send in a picture of your high score to, like, get in the magazine. Imagine, right? We can't do that today. Like, how do you prove you got the high score? You can fake anything with speed runs, emulators, Photoshop. But back in the day, if you just took a picture of your screen and sent it in, it's like, yep, that's authentic. You can get in the magazine. Oh, I miss those days for sure. So it's a wonderful interaction, the drama in it. You can definitely go and check that out. I'm pretty sure this is one you can see for free on YouTube. I've seen it there. If not, I'm sure you can find it somewhere online. The King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters. Well, those were three real-life video game stories put to film. Definitely check them out if you have an interest. I hope this was just a fun way to unwind. Thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.